I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. The numbers just don't seem to penetrate anymore. I can repeat them. 3 million dying every year from AIDS. Hundreds of thousands of orphans. Billions of dollars in aid needed. Even the words like pandemic and crisis and human catastrophe have been now used so often that they don't have the arresting power they once did. It is a source of considerable frustration for AIDS activists, chief among them the UN Special Envoy for HIV/AIDS in Africa. Stephen Lewis was picked for the job almost 3 years ago because of his persuasive and determined nature. And now he's sounding increasingly angry with the ongoing debate over the efficacy of generic drugs and the long conversations over whether money should go through the UN or the US or the other NGOs or just how bad the problem really is. I'd like to have you join us this hour. Is the developed world losing its interest in HIV/AIDS? Is that even possible? How do you see the problem? Is it with the UN or the US government, or is it just with us? Is it just that people don't see HIV/AIDS as a crisis anymore? Or is it that there are other problems in this country which require an equal amount of attention? You tell me. Our number's 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Stephen Lewis is, as I mentioned, the UN Special Envoy on HIV/AIDS in Africa. He's joining us this morning from NPR's New York studio. Hi, Stephen.
Good morning, Dick.
Good of you to be with us. And we also have with us on the phone from Johannesburg, Poloholo Ramatwala. Mr. Ramatwala is Assistant National Organizer for the Treatment Action Campaign. Hi, Mr. Ramatwala.
Good morning.
I thank you for joining us. I know it is the end of your day. I wonder if there is something that you see in your job, some image that you see on a regular basis that for you, someone who works in this business, reminds you of just how severe the crisis is.
Thank you for inviting me. I think what you said earlier when you introduced this subject sums it up, that there's no ways that you can explain how people are dying, and there's no way that you can justify the way people are dying unnecessarily because they cannot get access to medicines. And unfortunately, that's what we are living with every day, and that's what we are seeing.
So when you direct my attention to some place around Joburg, would you send me to a hospital, to a cemetery? What would you have me see?
I'll send you to both. Hospitals are full now. A lot of people are dying from AIDS, and those people, if we treat them, we will avoid having so many people, you know, queuing up in hospitals. And unfortunately, if you go to cemeteries over the weekend, it's still the same thing. Many people are dying, young people that are dying from AIDS-related illnesses, which we know very well that we are able to prevent. It's just that there's no medicines.
Is it that there's no money for the medicine? Is it the unavailability of medicine? Tell me how you see the problem in ways that matter here in the United States.
Mostly it's not the issue of money. I think in South African context, it's not mainly about money, but it's access to cheaper medicines and specifically generic drugs. That one of the things that we have been saying lately is that the U.S. government has been trying to prevent developing countries in order to get generic medicines. And those are some of the difficulties that we are faced with. Money can still play a role, but I think allowing developing countries to be able to do whatever they can with whatever resources that they can provide for themselves without, you know, having all these laws blocking a left and right.
Stephen Lewis, you are visiting countries all over sub-Saharan Africa, specifically in your work as a special envoy. And when I listen to Mr. Ramatwala describe the problem with the generic drugs in South Africa, is that something that you see across the region, or does the problem vary from nation to nation?
It varies. South Africa is a very special case because I think, as Mr. Ramatwala would agree, there has been considerable resistance on the part of the government of South Africa to making drugs generally available and to respond to the catastrophe. And it is only now, even as we speak, that within South Africa, some of the treatment programs are beginning to be rolled out. But that country, I think, has suffered dreadfully from the encroaching of the pandemic and the way it has taken the heart out of South Africa. I remember Dick being in Alexander Township on the outskirts of Johannesburg, meeting with a group of grandmothers. Grandmothers go through this perverse business in life. They bury their own children, and then they look after their grandchildren. And I was meeting with a group of grandmothers. They called themselves the Go-Go Grannies because they were getting together to network and to chat. And one woman was silent. She wouldn't talk to me about what was happening until the end. And then it turned out that she was 73 years old. She had buried all five of her children between 2001 and 2003. All five in 3 years. She had four grandchildren who were HIV positive. She was about to bury them in the next little while. And two generations gone in the snap of a finger. And so when Mr. Ramatwala said there's no way of conveying the carnage unless you see it visually, the pain and the suffering, and the need for drugs then to provide treatment, to prolong life, becomes the essential in Africa, and this crazy struggle over generics or brand name drugs has to be brought to an end.
Mr. Ramatwala, when you hear people arguing about should the money come from this government or that government, and you know that Americans, you know, heard their president talk about $15 billion, are you seeing the money anywhere in South Africa? Is there any evidence of that now?
No, and I think it's not only the promised $15 billion by the U.S. government. We've got a serious problem about it because it has been pledged, but up to so far, nothing much has been done. And I think also, you know, the Global Fund has been started by developed countries pledging, you know, making all this noise that we're actually committing ourselves to do something about it, but. Every time you hear the Global Fund complaining that they are running out of money, we are not seeing any money. And that's why I said that it's in other countries like South Africa, like Mr. Lee said, it's not only about money, but it's the laws that are being created to prevent people from getting medicines. It might be different in other developing countries, but South Africa is a bit different also.
If we had 30% of the population of a country like France or Germany or Canada or the United States, you think this would be a very different story?
I believe so. I think there would be more resources committed to it. There will be more seriousness into the whole issue. And unfortunately, now it's now being used as, you know, it's just a small thing. Whereas people are dying in millions and millions, and we are not doing anything about it.
Mr. Ramatwala, I want to thank you for being... I'm sorry, Stephen, did you want to jump in here?
Well, I wanted to say one thing, even if it's a trifle provocative. I think the analogy you made with the Western world, if this were happening in the Western world, it simply wouldn't be happening. We would never permit it. And it therefore says something about the possibility that there's a dark streak of subterranean racism running through the absence of the Western response. There's something so profoundly wrong with the slowness, the insensitivity, the indifference with which we've responded over the years that it's almost inexplicable.
Any way of shaking people out of that, Mr. Ramatwala?
Yes, I think we need to try to get together, more especially as a international community. We have to put more pressure on our own governments to make sure that we do more in order to start treating people, because we all know that the medicines are there. We all know that the problem is that the affordability and making sure that everybody who needs them get access to it.
Thanks for being with us on the program today.
Thank you.
Polohole Ramatwala is Assistant National Organizer for the Treatment Action Campaign based in Johannesburg, South Africa. Stephen Lewis remains with us. He is UN Special Envoy for HIV/AIDS in Africa. And Stephen, you've had the job, as I said earlier in the program, for almost 3 years now, which means that you've had the opportunity to go to places in Africa and go back to those places in Africa. And recently you returned to the women's ward of the capital city hospital in Swaziland. I wonder if you can just tell me about what it was like to go back to that place after having seen it before.
Unfortunately, Dick, it reflected the constant growth of the pandemic. When I was there 3 years or so ago in the Mbabane General Hospital in the adult women's ward, the level of occupancy of the beds, about 60 or 70% of the beds were occupied by AIDS-related illnesses in the women's ward. This time it was, as before, a scene out of hell, where every cot is occupied by a woman in the terrible, terrible agonies of the illness. And then, I actually hadn't seen this previously, under every cot, on the floor, was another woman in similar anguish. And the level of AIDS-related illnesses had risen to over 90%. And now Swaziland has the highest prevalence rate in the world. So people are really struggling. You make the ultimate point at the beginning of the broadcast. How do we mobilize the world? How do we move more quickly? The dollars are beginning to flow, however slowly. We know that we have the drugs that can prolong life. How is it possible that we could be losing millions of people every year unnecessarily, particularly women, in disproportionate numbers, and we just let it go on?
You mentioned in conversation earlier with Mr. Ramatwala that the president of that country, Thabo Mbeki, had been slow to recognize this. I know the same problem, similar problem exists in Swaziland, which is still ruled by a king in a country that has no real democracy or no free press. And I need you to give me a more clear-headed assessment of how much that interferes with our ability to understand the nature of the problem. Because in so many cases, you say, well, geez, you know, those people aren't helping themselves, so what can we do?
But that has become a kind of vile canard, because while it was true until 3 or 4 years ago that the African leadership generally, with some very rare exceptions like President Museveni in Uganda, the African leadership generally was in a state of denial and silence. They themselves were traumatized by the extent of the pandemic, didn't want to deal with it, didn't want to deal with it in part because it involves human sexuality, and that's always so awkward to discuss publicly. But that's all changed, Dick. In the last 3 or 4 years, there's been a huge sea change in Africa. The political leadership overall, not everyone, but overall, they're speaking openly, forthrightly, frankly. It takes your breath away, the openness with which sexuality is discussed in public. The religious leadership, which had been defiantly obdurate in their refusal to get involved, they're now involved. The activists in the countries are involved. In South Africa, you couldn't have a more effective group than the Treatment Action Campaign. The countries are alert. The awareness is now high. They want desperately to turn this pandemic around. They just need some external assistance. It isn't that Africa can't handle the treatment, the care, the prevention. At this point, in significant measure, they can. They have just lacked the resources, and they've lacked the technical assistance, which outfits like World Health Organization can bring to compensate for the loss of capacity, because so many people have died in the health sector, the education sector, the agricultural sector. They've lost capacity, and their infrastructures are shattered. They're not as strong in their systems, their healthcare systems, and others.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. This hour we're talking about the struggle to get the developed world interested in paying the money required to bring about at least a slowdown in the spread of HIV/AIDS in developing countries. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. With so many domestic demands in this country, do you think that the U.S. involvement should be limited, or is this the time to move in some sort of dramatic fashion? 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. There's a story in this morning's Washington Post that talks about the spread of AIDS and its effect in KwaZulu-Natal in western South Africa. And I just wanted to read you a couple of paragraphs. Sister Priscilla called out two names, and the women made their way through the crowd. Sister Priscilla handed each of them a green booklet that resembled a passport, the identity documents of their dead children. Quote, "We take the identification document and make a picture of the person's ID photo. Then we make up boxes, memory boxes that contain the picture of the dead parent and some other things that were special to them, and we give it to their children so they have something of their parents," she said. Some of the dying arrive at the hospital with nothing, not even identification documents. "In that case," says Priscilla, "we give them a stone to hold before they die and tell the children, 'Your mother held this stone.'" Our number is 1-800-423-8255. This hour we're talking about AIDS in Africa with Stephen Lewis, who is the UN Special Envoy for HIV/AIDS in Africa. Stephen, I know in your trip to Swaziland, you too were struck by what's happening with the number of children who have no parents in that country.
Yeah, it probably has the highest ratio of orphans in southern Africa. More than 10% of the entire population will soon be orphan children, overwhelmingly orphaned by AIDS. I was listening to you reading those Washington Post extracts, and I thought to myself, Dick, that one of the most horrendous things about this pandemic is that the children stand and watch their parents die. You just can't imagine it. Even in Swaziland, I trekked into the hinterland through a long footpath to a little home, a little hut far in the interior. A group of women wanted to show me how they handled the care of people who were dying in their homes. And I entered the hut, and there was a woman on her bed. She was so sick. I was shaking because it was so sad. This happens all the time. And sitting in the hut and watching her die were her children. And this happens all the time. Children don't become orphans when their parents die. They become orphans when their parents get sick. And they tend to their parents. They wash their parents. They clean up their parents. They try to cope emotionally as their parents slowly disintegrate before their eyes. And then they're orphan kids, and then they are looked after by grandmothers, or they live in child-headed households where siblings look after each other. I just can't get over the sort of emotional toll that is taken on a country and its people as the pandemic takes its grip. I also can't get over the fact that we could put an end to it. We know how to put an end to it, and it's as though the world were immobilized.
Our number is 1-800-423-8255. I'm going to take a first call from Boston, Massachusetts. Mike's on the line. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Dick. How are you doing?
Fine.
I was listening, and well, your guest kind of answered my question already. I was wondering about what's being done to stop the spread of the pandemic. I mean, I heard a lot of all the money that should be going into, you know, the drugs and whatnot. But I mean, what is it? Is it the effect? Are the methods to stop it, are they showing up to be effective? I mean, or is there a lot of societal or religious impediments to getting, you know, these people to use, you know, to have safe sex or to whatever it takes so that, you know, this doesn't keep on going? And also, is there anything working against that? I mean, like, for instance, I don't know, I've heard that certain Catholic organizations are, you know, they say not to use these things that would stop birth control, whatever.
No condoms.
And what is going on that end? And one other comment.
Let's just take it like that, if we can, Mike, because I don't want it to get too complicated. When we talk about why the problem continues to get worse rather than better, how much of it is our problems that exist in Africa, Stephen? How much of it are problems that exist with money and funding?
Look, there's no question that the prevention campaigns have sometimes been effective. In Uganda, there was a tremendous prevention campaign where the president of the country talked about AIDS nonstop, day in and day out, where he ordered every member of his cabinet to do the same, where there was a tremendous awareness across the country, and the prevalence rates dropped from something in the vicinity of 25% to 30% back in the early and mid-90s to 6% today. So these intense prevention campaigns can undoubtedly be helpful, whether you're focusing on abstinence or being faithful or using condoms. All those things are being pursued in every country now, and the levels of awareness are often very high. There are amongst the youth, alas, still many misconceptions, but gradually even that's being overcome. But what we've learned is that it's tremendously difficult, even when you're aware, to change sexual behavior. That behavior change is the toughest thing of all. And because the virus is driven by predatory male sexual behavior, that's what drives the virus, men are very difficult to get to change their behavior. In the meantime, we're losing millions of women. And you have to empower women. You have to find a way of protecting women. You have to give them, beyond their culture, the capacity to say no, to insist on the wearing of the condom, to negotiate sex. All of these things are very difficult. You can't just deal with them in a flippant way. Suffice to say that Africa is trying, and trying very hard. What it needs as a tremendous encouragement is the availability of treatment, so that people know that if they test themselves and they're HIV positive, that they haven't got a death warrant, that they can turn to drugs and they can prolong their lives, and mothers will live and children won't become orphaned, and everybody has a quotient of hope, and then you gradually defeat the pandemic. But now we're at a kind of stalemate until we break through on the treatment front.
Can we talk a little bit about the money side, though, Stephen? Because one of the things that you've been saying lately is that the World Health Organization, in its capacity, and the Global Funds for AIDS, which is administered by the United Nations, is, in your view, really the best way of getting at that. How do you make that case? Because there are, as you know, all these other national governments, the U.S. among them, who prefer to put the money out with names attached to their nation, you know, the Danish AIDS Fund or the President's Fund in this country. Why should the money go through the UN?
Well, first of all, the Global Fund, Dick, you'll forgive a tiny correction, is not a UN administered agency. It is a totally new creation with a quite different and actually inventive board, 7 developed and 7 developing countries, and NGOs, non-governmental organizations, represented on the board. It's very unusual in its construct. It was suggested initially by Kofi Annan back in 2001. He felt that there would be several billion dollars a year available for the Global Fund, a heady chunk of which would come from the United States. It hasn't happened. The Global Fund is struggling along with $2 or $3 billion a year rather than the $7 or $8 billion a year which everyone hoped it would reach. The United States, last year President Bush recommended $200 million. Congress moved that up to $550 million. This year President Bush has gone back down to $200 million. It was quite a devastating blow to most of the activists that only $200 million of the $2 billion in new money every year in the President Bush initiative would go to the Global Fund. Why the Global Fund? Because you need an international body which coordinates all these interventions, because it drives these recipient countries crazy when individual Western governments are dictating how their money should be used, which drugs should be purchased, what are the priorities. You've got to fit within the priorities of the government itself. You have to have respect for the rights of the country to work out the treatment and care programs for its own people. And the Global Fund was a way of mobilizing an international response. The World Health Organization said, rather dramatically, that they wanted to see 3 million people into treatment by 2005, call it 3 by 5. And they said in order to do that, they would not only need money from the Global Fund, but they themselves would require $200 million this year and next to train 100,000 doctors, nurses, pharmacists, community health workers, counselors, to provide the technical assistance for capacity and infrastructure, to make sure that the drugs were moving through the pipeline. They were going to put everything in place, and lo and behold, they can't get even the $200 million. And I don't want to rattle on, it's inappropriate on radio, but I want to make one point. We're going to spend, within the next year or so, a total overall of $200 billion to fight wars in Afghanistan and Iraq and reconstruct those countries. And we can't find 0.1% of that money to save several million lives. Dick, there's something wrong with the moral anchor of the international community.
I'd like to bring Dr. Wafa El-Sadr into the program now. She's Director of Global HIV Care and Treatment Programs at the Columbia Mailman School of Health, and she's also Chief of the Division of Infectious Disease at Harlem Hospital. She's been listening to our conversation. Dr. Wafa, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Now, your program received some of the money from the Bush AIDS package that we were talking about, am I right?
Yes, that's correct.
And I'm not asking you on to argue with Stephen about how best to fund this, but I, as a as someone who's trying to make sense of it from a layman's perspective, some of the money comes from the United States. Some of the money comes from the Global Fund. I take Stephen's correction on it not being UN money. But how are ordinary people supposed to look at the way that the different funds and different money is being put to use in coping with AIDS and say, well, this is right and this is wrong or this is good or this is bad?
Well, I actually agree completely with Stephen in his analysis. I think in the end there are tremendous needs, and that was very eloquently talked about earlier. There are tremendous needs in these countries, and tremendous needs for a lot of resources. And it's critical that wherever the resources are coming from, that there would be coordinated efforts in countries that is completely consistent with these particular country plans and their own approach to HIV care and treatment and their own global HIV control programs in these countries. So in the end, we need whatever program is funded, any and all of these programs should really be dependent and be shaped by the people on the ground, the people in the countries themselves who are going to have to develop the kinds of programs that are appropriate for their own populations.
Now, this money that you've got from the Bush Fund, that allows you to treat more people in places like Tanzania and Botswana and Nigeria, is that right?
The funding we have received is focused on development of HIV care and treatment programs with partners on the ground in five countries in sub-Saharan Africa. And these countries include Rwanda, Mozambique.
Okay, I'm getting you confused
Kenya
with a different program.
Yes, yes.
All right,
Kenya, South Africa, and Tanzania.
Right, and then Stephen, how does that get coordinated? So you don't have Dr. Wafa showing up in Kenya with one program while someone else is trying to do exactly the same thing.
Ah, you see, but that's the strength of the Columbia School of Public Health and what WAFA is overseeing, because what they're doing is integrated directly into the country's priorities. They're doing something called prevention of mother-to-child transmission plus, where they not only stop the transmission of the virus from the mother to child during the birthing process, but they also treat the mother. And then, if necessary, they treat the partner. And then, if necessary, they treat the children. And they care for the entire family. And this is a priority in the five countries which WAFA identified, so that's a very intelligent use of the money. And frankly, it's an intelligent decision on the part of the U.S. government to give it to Colombia and the work they're doing. I'm not pretending that some of the administration money, or all of it indeed, won't be used for, by and large, useful things. It's just that we have to be careful in the way the priorities work themselves out and in acknowledging and honoring what countries need.
Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Let's take a call from Raleigh, North Carolina. Frank's been waiting on the line. Hi, Frank.
Yes, sir. Good morning.
Thanks for calling.
Yes, sir. First of all, I think it is essential that the people of Africa finally understand that there is a price to be paid for freedom. If you want to walk as a free man, you had first better be able to stand on your own two legs. I go back to the case of the war in Rwanda. When those refugees fled to the Zairean border, then President Mobutu Sese Seko put his troops on the border and ordered them to shoot to kill anyone.
Frank, where are you going with this? I'm not quite sure I'm following.
I'm telling you, sir, quite frankly, that Mr. Mobutu Sese Seko had his own gold mine. There is no shortage of money in Africa, no shortage of wealth, of abundant natural resources. The problem is
So you're saying let Africa solve its own problems?
The people of Africa, if they're not happy with their circumstance, they must turn to their own capitals, to their own governments, and solve the problem there. They cannot continually look, they threw their white masters off from colonial rule, and more power to them. This country did the same. They have every opportunity to solve this problem themselves. They will not if money keeps coming in from overseas to solve the problem for them.
Frank, just hold on a second. I'd like to let Stephen in here. Don't go away, though.
Well, how disrespectful do you want me to be, Dick? I mean, it's just palpable nonsense. While it is true that in three or four quite egregious instances, African leaders, and Mobutu is one of the best examples, have as it were, scrounged every penny out of their countries and put it away in foreign banks. That has happened. By the way, similarly, inappropriate political behavior has also happened in the Western world. Let's not get too smug and self-righteous about it. But it is also true that Africa has been plundered by multinational corporations which have taken control in these countries. Africa's political and economic priorities were distorted in the late 1980s and 90s as they struggled in the post-independence period by perverse policies under the name of structural adjustment programs imposed by the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund and the international community. Africa was trapped by the behavior, the depredations of the Western world, and for quite a considerable period in the pre-Cold War, in the earlier Cold War days, by the so-called Eastern world. Africa has not had the freedom to walk. By the way, it would be nice if the women of Africa could walk, as well as the men, by the way. And I just think that this take on African history is so ill-informed, is so prejudiced, that it's just out of sync. It's not real, and it certainly hasn't been real over the last several years.
Frank, are you still there?
Yes, I would like to respond.
I've got about 30 seconds for you.
A German company, and I wish I could recall their name, offered to provide free of charge a drug given to women with HIV that would prevent the contamination of their newborns. Only two African countries of, 58 sovereign nations accepted this. One of them was Uganda, and I don't remember the other one.
What's your point, though, Frank?
The point, sir, is that the governments of Africa are only interested in fattening their pockets, and that the Western world cares more about their dying people than their own governments do. And that circumstance will not cease until those people have the guts to stand up and take their lives and their futures into their own hands and do something themselves.
I'm going to stop you there, Frank. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. We'll continue the conversation when we come back after the break. Connection listeners, do you share the perspective that Frank has, that this is not a problem that can be or even should be solved by developed countries? Or do you take Stephen Lewis's point of view that that is palpable nonsense? 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. You've seen the news stories. You've read the figures in the newspapers and heard them on the radio and the debates about drugs and the different way of funding and the proper ways of approaching the crisis of HIV/AIDS, specifically in Africa. That's what we're talking about this hour. And with us on the program, Stephen Lewis, UN Special Envoy for HIV/AIDS in Africa, Dr. Wafa El-Sadr, Director of Global HIV Care and Treatment Programs at the Columbia Mailman School of Health. Now, you two both spent a lot of time in Africa, and I don't want to dwell too much on the point that Frank was making, but I think that it's worth acknowledging that there are a lot of people in this country who have this sort of, well, why don't they fix their own problem first attitude, and that alone, Dr. Wafa, allows people to say, so talk to me about AIDS funding next year or the year after that. What's your perspective, your view on that type of attitude?
I think that what we have learned over the past year or so, even in our own program, the NTTT Plus initiative, is that it's quite possible and feasible to actually work very closely with people on the ground in many of these countries to build very successful programs. There's the interest, there's the devotion, there's the commitment right there on the ground to build HIV care and treatment programs and successful ones. And just very recently, we had a meeting of all of our program staff from all of the different programs that we have helped fund in 8 countries around the globe. And it was rather remarkable how in a short period of time...
I'm sorry, Dr. Wafa, I'm talking about the attitude of people here who don't think that this is a priority and what you say to them.
Well, I think what Stephen has said critically is that it is a very important responsibility that we have in the global community. There's suffering, a tremendous amount of suffering that's happening day in, day out, and we can make a difference. They can make a difference. And I feel that the American public, when they know that they can make a difference and make a difference that's very quickly can be palpable, can be seen, as we've noted ourselves, that they will support these programs.
So Stephen Lewis, how do you get to that part of the American public that Dr. Wafa is talking about? How do you get past this sort of "don't bother me with this" attitude from people like Frank?
You just, Dick, in my experience, you just work at it relentlessly. You try to overcome the misinformation, like Frank's reference to the German firm. It's actually a firm called Boehringer Ingelheim, which offered nevirapine free, which was accepted by a significant number of countries. Other countries are negotiating it. You know, Africa gets concerned about free offer of free things because they have to be sustained. This pandemic isn't going away, and if you offer something free for 2 years or 3 years or 5 years, what happens at the end of that time? How much are you forced to pay? Can you continue to treat your people? These problems are much more complex than the knee-jerk Pavlovian hostility would make you think. I agree with Wafa that if we keep talking about what is being done positively, if we keep, through programs like this and articles like that of the Washington Post and in the Boston Globe and in the New York Times and sometimes in TV vehicles, we convey to the American people what is really happening, then there is a tremendous reservoir of human decency and compassion in this country. I'm a Canadian, as indeed are you, but I'm a Canadian. I know the United States. I've lived beside the United States. There are obviously different ideologies at war, but the fundamental decency of the people, the way in which they responded in the post-war period in Europe, the way in which they will rescue countries in the heat of need when there are economic and social priorities, the rank-and-file Americans are tremendously generous. So, Dick, you just keep hammering away relentlessly until the breakthrough comes, and one day it does come.
Let's go to Orleans, Massachusetts. Heather's been waiting on the phone. Hi, Heather. Thanks for calling.
Hello. I don't actually have a question. I have a point of view. I found out that I was HIV positive about 2 years ago. And what I've found is that people don't know that it's treatable. I tell friends and they say, oh, I'm sorry, as though I'm going to die tomorrow. I was in Africa in 96 and I saw the new graves and they were in severe denial back then. I think they're not as much in denial now. People aren't saying it's all pneumonia. They're saying they died of AIDS. But what I think is that the United States operates on fear, and our news is often based on fear. And back when it was a gay disease, which it isn't, it was front page news, and now it isn't. And my friends don't even know it's treatable. They don't know I'll probably live a normal length life. I did have a hard time getting my medications, though.
Heather, let me just, I'm a little bit lost on something here. Are you saying that, yeah, that people in this country have a kind of laissez-faire about Africa's problems because they do know that it's treatable, or that they don't know
they
that it's treatable?
They don't. 95% of my friends think as soon as they found out, they thought I was going to die.
So you say, what you're saying is the case needs to be made that these lives can be saved, that people don't even know that.
Yeah. I think that people don't realize it's treatable, therefore they brush under the carpet as though it's a hopeless matter.
Stephen, does this sound familiar to you?
Well, it's certainly interesting, and to the extent that it is true, and Heather's experience would be very real and vivid if she's HIV positive, she would have talked to all her friends about it. If there is that misunderstanding, then that is something further that we have to clear up. But my experience has always been, Dick, when you set out what is happening, when you describe what can be done, when you tell people how hard Africa is working to overcome what is happening and how much progress is being made on the ground and how much more could be made with some resources and some assistance, the response is very powerful. You know, this is pretty presumptuous, and I don't want to particularly get my boss, Kofi Annan, in trouble, but your problem, in my view, is the political leadership in the Western world. It's not the public. I see that in my own country of Canada. The public is unbelievably generous and filled with concern. The political leadership moves very, very slowly.
Why?
You've nailed me. I don't understand why. I think they misread their own publics. I think they feel that their immediate domestic concerns are all that will ring responses in people. And they don't understand that people will similarly respond to desperate human circumstances in other parts of the world. That's been characteristic, whether it was the Marshall Plan, or whether it was our response to the Ethiopian famine, or whether it was our response to the refugees at the end of the Rwandan genocide. People will respond to the human predicament if the political leadership encourages it.
Our number is 1-800-423-TALK. Let's go to Portsmouth, New Hampshire now. Mark's with us. Hi, Mark.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm fine. Thanks for calling.
Good. I'm a venture capitalist, and I'm focused on an AIDS prevention program for Africa. And one of the things that I've been doing is doing a lot of research, and I really do think that more of this community and needs to be focused on the prevention issues here, which fundamentally are two alternatives. One is condom use, and the other is abstinence. And the culture in Africa, in my opinion, does not lend itself to abstinence. So when you're looking at condom use, I think you are talking pretty much about empowering women to insist on condom use, which Steve has alluded to, and also legislating the right...
Mark, can I just stop you for half a second? Why is it that you dismiss the antiretrovirals as...
I don't at all. But I do think that there needs to be far more focus on prevention. There was listening to a radio program when you had two college students, two females, age 20, who felt that they weren't going to live past 30 because they were going to get married, and they knew that their husbands were going to have sex outside the marriage, and they were to come back and give their wives AIDS. There does have to be a tremendous focus here on condom use. And unfortunately, in several countries, the Catholic Church is opposed to condom use. Men's behavior has to be changed. There has to be a real focus here on prevention.
I know that, Stephen, one of the conundrums that you came up against in your own recent sort of focusing in on women in Africa was the predicament for the married woman. That help me with this, that she has a very difficult time saying to her husband, darling, you're wearing a condom tonight.
Absolutely. The so-called ABC of the prevention mantra, A is for abstinence, B is for be faithful, and C is for a condom, doesn't work in marriage. And in Africa, there's a very high percentage of women being infected. A recent survey in Botswana showed 38% of women infected in what they believe to be monogamous marriages. In a marriage, you can't talk about abstinence. It's neither possible nor desirable. You can't say be faithful. That's an assumption of the marriage. And condom use isn't easy to negotiate. So we have to find new ways of enforcing and encouraging prevention. Absolutely. And we've got to overcome the church resistance to the use of condoms, which gradually is happening in much of Africa. The fact of the matter is, I think, if I can say to this caller, that the treatment and prevention are inseparable. They're both absolutely vital, and you can't do one without the other. You have to do two simultaneously. Until now, we have tended to focus on prevention and have allowed treatment to be neglected. This is a way of righting the balance and making prevention that much stronger.
And Dr. Wafa, in your work in Africa, I don't know whether or not the women have an easier time speaking to you because you're a woman doctor, but when Mark talks about the need to push hard for prevention, is there a lot of work that can be done there?
There is a tremendous need for more work on prevention, certainly. However, I agree with Stephen, is that what we have seen is in communities where you introduce care and treatment, there's a change, a dramatic change that happened within that community. And it allows for, hopefully, for more successful prevention efforts. People have seen that when you have care and treatment, people are able to acknowledge their own HIV infection, talk about it more openly. And as people identify themselves with HIV and are able to speak about their own lives, this is a much more of a appropriate environment where prevention messages can succeed. The issue of gender is a very big issue, and I think there's a need for prevention methods, and there are strategies, there are sensitive to the situation that women face every day and that can be utilized by women. There's research going on now to identify possibly microbicides, which are substances that can prevent a woman from getting HIV infected. And that effort needs to continue, but I think it's the synergy between care and treatment and prevention that's going to make us be able to successfully control this epidemic. We have to succeed on two fronts. We have to succeed in keeping people alive and healthy and productive, and we have to succeed in preventing new infections, and we can't focus on one and not the other. And I think together, synergistically working on both, we're much more likely to have a positive impact.
We're coming near the end of the program, and Stephen Lewis, there was one thing I wanted to ask you about. It was a BBC report that I saw, coincidentally, from Swaziland, and I think it was about a year ago, in which the reporter tried to make the case that that taking this thing apart and talking about prevention and care or mothers or orphans or hospitals or hospices or cemeteries is in many ways to lose sight of the fact that if it goes on, in a sense, the society is finished, that there aren't enough people to feed the people who live, that there aren't enough people to care for the children who survive. It was like a terrifyingly apocalyptic view of what that one small country could become. Was that over the top?
No. No, it wasn't. Absolutely not. If you eat away at a country long enough, if you lose your productive age groups, people in their 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, Dick, you can't imagine the number of women who are dying in their 20s. It's absolutely nightmarish. And you just gradually remove the capacity of a country to function. I met the Minister of Agriculture of Zambia recently. He told me about a major meeting he'd gone to attend with 10 members of the European Community. They wanted to talk to him about genetically modified foods. He said to me, "I went to meet them alone." I said, "Mr. Minister, that's kind of nuts. That's a pretty sophisticated delegation. Why did you go alone?" He said, "Stephen, so many senior members of my ministry are dead or are ill, I had no one to take with me." And when you think of that in the health sector, when you think of that in the education sector, the teachers who are dying, you have to understand that you tear the heart out of a society. And there are countries which are going to struggle for survival. There's no question.
Stephen, thanks for being with us on the program today.
Thanks for having me.
Stephen Lewis is UN Special Envoy for HIV/AIDS in Africa. Dr. Wafa El-Sadr, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Dr. Wafa is Director of Global HIV Care and Treatment Programs at Columbia University. Earlier in the program, we talked with Polaholo Ramatwala, the Assistant National Organizer for the Treatment Action Campaign in Johannesburg, South Africa. We have some links on our website to the Global Fund, to the World Health Organization, to the Treatment Action Campaign, and some of the other things that we've referred to in the program today if you'd like to pursue this a little bit further. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.